Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, February 16, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome a return guest, Adam Perlman. He's a special advisor in the International National Security Law Practice Group. He's going to act as the moderator today, and welcome Governor Tom Ridge. He's the chairman at Ridge Global. He's formerly the first secretary of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security when it was originally formed, and the former governor of the great state of Pennsylvania. We're very pleased to welcome both of you today. I mentioned that Adam Perlman's going to moderate. He's going to begin with a series of questions he'll pose to the governor. But as always, we'll be looking to the audience for your questions, so please be thinking of those for when we get to that portion of the program. With that, the floor is yours, Adam Perlman.
All right. Thank you, Dean, and good afternoon, everybody, and thank you for your interest in this topic and this series. Since this is the first part in the three-part series, I'm going to take the opportunity to briefly describe the thread that ties all three calls together before getting into today's topic in depth. First, however, because my day job is as a bureaucrat of sorts, I am compelled to note that any views I express today are mine alone and do not necessarily reflect the policy or position of the Department of Defense or any agency of the U.S. government. Now, this series was actually conceived quite a while ago as a way to examine certain aspects of the federal government's relationship with other entities. While protecting the security of the United States and American citizens is a primary responsibility of the national government, it is generally accepted that federal agencies and authorities cannot, neither in law nor capacity, be the sole provider of security in the modern world. As an organization of limited, if vast, authorities and means, the U.S. government must, and often does, partner with other organizations to achieve specific strategic and tactical goals. Just like the classical economic concept of comparative advantage, at each level, partners can leverage certain capabilities that the U.S. government may not be able to as effectively as the partnering entity. Today, where national security threats often germinate from subnational or stateless cells and asymmetric actors, partners take on different urgency as we work to be nimble enough to defeat and hopefully preempt the ever-evolving threat landscape. And in an age where information is the basis of a great deal of power, we picked three topics: the federal, state, and local partnerships in counterterrorism, public-private partnerships in cybersecurity, and foreign government partnerships and alliances as a way to survey how dimensions of federalism, capitalism, and globalism can come into play when it comes time to decide whether, when, and how to share valuable information. Today, we have an eminently respected expert speaking about the dynamics between the Fed, state, and local partnerships in the counterterrorism sphere. And over the last 15 years, as many of you know, Homeland Security has really become a field unto itself. At the federal level, DHS became the second largest executive department and includes three law enforcement agencies and a uniformed service in the U.S. Coast Guard. But the heavy responsibility of keeping Americans safe at home extends well beyond the jurisdiction of that department alone. Still at the national level, the Department of Justice has four law enforcement agencies of its own, and the Department of Defense is authorized to support domestic law enforcement and disaster response operations in under certain circumstances. And the Departments of State, Treasury, Interior, Transportation, and Energy all have components that perform some sort of domestic security-related function. Looking vertically at the federal structure, DHS-led intelligence fusion centers and FBI-led joint terrorism task forces, or JTTFs, each include state, local, or tribal personnel to help accomplish their missions. This has led to some local controversies, with certain municipalities directing their police forces not to participate in joint counterterrorism efforts. Likewise, surplus military-grade equipment has increasingly proliferated into local law enforcement, leading many to criticize the so-called militarization of policing. And finally, the rise of sanctuary cities also pits some localities against federal immigration laws in ways that have significance for counterterrorism efforts. This first episode in our Security Partnership Teleforum series will explore the limits of federal, state, local, and tribal cooperation. We are privileged to have with us today Governor Tom Ridge, as Dean mentioned, the first Secretary of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Governor Ridge is an Army veteran who served in Vietnam, where he earned a Bronze Star in addition to numerous other citations. A graduate of Harvard and later the Dickinson School of Law, he became a prosecutor in Erie County, Pennsylvania, before being elected to 6 terms in the U.S. House of Representatives, becoming the first Vietnam combat veteran elected to the House. He then served 2 terms as governor of Pennsylvania before becoming the first assistant to the President for Homeland Security and then the first Secretary of DHS. And since his tenure at DHS, he's been appointed to several boards of directors and continued his public service as co-chair of the Blue Ribbon Study Panel on Biodefense, in addition to being the chairman of Ridge Global, which includes divisions specializing in consulting on and capital investment in homeland security and cyber enterprises. Now, Governor Ridge, within 10 days of the 9/11 attacks, President Bush asked you to become his homeland security advisor. Can you start us off by describing what it was like to start this enterprise essentially from scratch while in the midst of a national security crisis?
Well, first of all, Adam, let me just thank you and the Federalist Society for the opportunity to participate in this conversation. I welcome it, and again, many thanks. At the outset, I think it's important, particularly given the nature of the group, to dispel a myth that was associated with the creation of the department. I know there was initially some criticism that we were going to build a brand new department with 180,000 new federal employees, and there was understandably a resistance to that notion when many people thought what the government doesn't necessarily need to do is get bigger, it just needs to get more effective, and there are very few people that think bigger necessarily means effective. So starting the department, there was really an aggregation of basically 5 or 6 really major components and then bits and pieces from multiple other organizations. We end up with 180,000 people. Ironically, and I cannot explain the difference to this, the justification to the audience, I am told it's now up to 240,000 people, and for the life of me, don't know where the other 60,000 are doing. But having said that, going back to the initial days of this, this agency, there were some groups that came in and some entities that came in, and they were comfortable from being reassigned from one department to another. Some were disappointed and some were downright unhappy and one might even say hostile. But what I think was most important to note from during the midst of this national security crisis, there was a sense of mission, a sense of mission that was able to overcome all those other emotions that were running through the veins of the different agency heads and the 180,000 people moved in the department. It was and remains to be a challenge. It remains to be a challenge because Congress didn't restructure itself in order to provide the appropriate oversight over the committee. It remains a challenge because we still haven't integrated all the capabilities, but frankly, it's going to be a while before we get it up to where we need it to be. And frankly, I think one of the primary reasons is that the jurisdiction of Congress is so disparate. I ended up testifying more frequently before Congress as the secretary of a brand new department than Donald Rumsfeld did, and he had 2 wars going on, one in Iraq and one in Afghanistan. But progress has been made, but still much more to do.
Right. So can you break that down a little bit between cooperation among the agencies within the department, cooperation between the department and its federal peers, and then the vertical component with the state and local partners?
Absolutely. Initially, and I think it was very predictable, there was much resistance to the organization, the reorganization itself, that was privately expressed by many of my colleagues who were heading other cabinet agencies. Initially, there was a call for better communication, collaboration. You know, you've heard all those terms before. It wasn't until the president decided that we need a border-centric agency in the 21st century, even prior to the 9/11 attack, we had failed to create an agency that monitored people and goods coming across our borders. And in the 21st century, it seems to be an appropriate role for government even prior to the 9/11 attack. Well, obviously, once the president decided that this is what we're going to do and the department was created, then that horizontal integration became absolutely critical. Now, it took a while. Some agencies were far more willing to cooperate than others. One of the biggest challenges, since we were the conduit of relevant information potentially shared with the state and locals, was getting that kind of intelligence information that might be useful if our primary responsibility at the time was to ensure that another attack did not occur, was getting the CIA and the FBI. Remember, that firewall, the Gorlick firewall that had existed, where it said the your international surveillance and your law enforcement couldn't share information, that had been broken. So getting those two agencies to cooperate and provide on a timely basis relevant information to the department was a fairly significant challenge, and one which was overcome over a period of time. The vertical integration was much easier to the extent that as a former governor, I appreciated the value that governors and adjutant generals and mayors and their chiefs of police would play in the additional role that Homeland Security had. So that is, I think, frankly, went a lot easier. And we began to build that very strategic relationship with our partners vertically. I've said this then, I say it now and forevermore, you cannot possibly maximize your ability to reduce the threat of terrorism. You cannot possibly maximize your ability to secure this country from inside the Beltway. A lot of good programs and a lot of good people, but unless you have this vertical integration of assets, people, and technology, you just can't get it done. So it took a while, but I think there's been a lot of progress, particularly, well, both horizontal and vertical.
Now, I had mentioned something about, the fusion centers and JTTF. Can
right.
you tell us a little bit more about the structures of those organizations and the roles that they're playing?
Well, the Joint Terrorism Task Forces actually existed before 9/11. But FBI Director Bob Mueller very appropriately saw the benefit of expanding the number and the reach. And so basically, the JTTFs are on either a state or a regional or larger urban area venue where you have the integration on a regular basis of a lot of people representing the multiple federal agencies, but they interact with the state and local, particularly the law enforcement, and primarily around the notion of counterterrorism. The fusion centers are like a one-off of the JTFs, where the focus is really the state and local law enforcement combined with first responders, public health, where they are able to share information, analyze information, distribute information. Some of that information they may actually get from the JTTFs. But in both situations, you have people there on an ongoing basis getting information, potentially turning it into intelligence, analyzing it, turning it into intelligence, much of it is then actionable, and sharing it with the appropriate individuals who can act upon it. The fusion centers, primarily focused on state and local, the JTTFs, heavy emphasis on federal with integration primarily with local and regional law enforcement.
Now, so who, when it comes to operations, who has tasking authority in this? And by that I mean, do the federal authorities commission local law enforcement to do things like surveil potential threats, or can local law enforcement can go up the chain, as it were, to the feds and say, hey, we've identified this, you need to do something about it?
Excuse me, Adam. I think that is a very important question that I think the country, or at least the people who should answer that question are still somewhat undecided. And let me put it this way. There are X number of men and women working with the FBI, but there are over 700,000 men and women in state and local law enforcement. And one of the challenges that I think the country still has is developing a system whereby the federal government, I mean particularly the FBI, on occasion can share timely and relevant information on a selective basis with the appropriate people in the local law enforcement community to primarily enhance their capability to surveil, to keep their eyes on potential individuals who the FBI believes is a potential threat. Now, there's a real problem here with trust. And the challenge is twofold. One, the FBI needs to understand that they'll never have the human capacity to keep eyes on everyone that deserves to have that kind of scrutiny at the local level. And secondly, there has to be an element of trust between these federal officials and that local police chief so that they will entrust them with the information and they will not empower the entire police force, but the right individuals in that region, in that police force, in order to enhance the FBI's capability to surveil potential threats. Now, it's a difficult example to raise with you in the audience, but I had occasion to talk to Commissioner Ed Davis, who was commissioner of the police in Boston at the time the Marathon attacks. And the commissioner told me that he was notified about the Sarnoff brothers after the bombs went off. I say that as a frame of reference. Whether or not the FBI, whether or not that incident could have been avoided had there been one or two of the commissioner's chief trusted members of his department keeping surveilling these individuals, I don't know. But that shows you there's still a gap between the federal government and the local government, and a lack of trust, I think, in terms of sharing that information. And I put an exclamation point on the notion that if we can't trust each other in this effort to minimize the local terrorist threat, then who can we trust? If law enforcement can't trust law enforcement, we'll never again maximize our ability to reduce the potential of attack.
So is trust alone the bottleneck there? Is there an element of sources and methods protection that also comes into play? I suppose the two are related. You can't really extract them from each other. But where does the federal government draw the line on protecting its sources and methods versus?
Well, I think it's a very fair question. I think it's a very fair question. First of all, I think the chances are rare. I mean, first of all, there would be no need to share the source of information that would be known by the federal government when you share that kernel of information that would generate the local action. So the local has no idea where the FBI, how it obtained the information. They would only need to know that the FBI considered it salient, and based on its relevance, we want you to assist us in the surveillance or whatever their capability that they were going to tap into. And I just, for me, it's difficult, particularly if your counterterrorism effort is directed toward identifying a potential actor or actors before they act. On those rare occasions, would somebody have to say protecting the source? If divulging that kernel of information means that I might, there's a possibility that the source would be then revealed, and you weighed that against the notion that, but if we don't take these individuals or that individual off the street, the likelihood of a terrorist attack becomes real. Somebody's got to make the trade-off. My trade-off would be in those unlikely circumstances when the source or method would be identified, I'd still take the person off the street.
Now, I guess this comes into play in another way these last several weeks with respect to immigration in particular and its ties to broader national security policy and the roles that local law enforcement have or in some cases have not been playing over the last few years. How in your view, did the new executive orders alter the balance, and does it do they serve to enforce the immigration laws that are already on the books and perhaps keep us safer in the counterterrorism sense?
Well, I'm going to try to avoid this sounding like a political commentary, but first of all, the travel ban was inartfully executed, inartfully rolled out, and I suspect that as we speak, you've got some lawyers inside the White House that are going to do a lot better job, hopefully, of getting something that would pass not only judicial muster, potentially, but also dealing with the whole public relations game, and it's a very important one that is played. So I just want to put that aside and assume that they're going to correct what transpired. The question that I have, and nobody's been able to answer, is almost a hyperventilated notion. I admit there's a possibility, but the notion that there is a body of evidence, there's a body of circumstances, there's a trail of incidents that suggest that refugees from these seven countries have actually been responsible for terrorist attacks in the United States to date. That doesn't necessarily mean they won't be in the future, because I think terrorists, some of them operate under a different time frame. We have watches, they have time. They'll obviously perhaps execute whatever destructive means they want in all good time. But if you look from 2001 into 2017, this date, I don't believe there is a single incident or arrest attendant to either an incident or a preemptive interdiction by the FBI where it involved a refugee from one of those seven countries. My point being is that it's very appropriate for the president, a new president, to say, I want to take a look at these vetting requirements. I may want to make them more stringent. But I think the whole notion that we have to do it now because there's a the possibility of another horrific terrorist act will confront us through one of these refugees. There's nothing in the past 15 years that they could base this almost hyperbolic notion that we have to do it. We have to do it now. And as the circuit court, as the court said, have to question do it in an unconstitutional way.
Now, you had mentioned earlier the Gorelick memo with the firewall with between domestic and foreign surveillance, which for audience members, former Deputy Attorney General Jamie Gorelick pretty much ordered national security investigators and criminal investigators that back in the 90s, ne'er the two shall meet. And there was a big wall between intelligence and the criminal sphere. And indeed, there's judicial precedent distinguishing foreign intelligence surveillance from domestic surveillance for domestic security purposes. But is, especially now, is how much are those being blurred, and are they being blurred even more so when it comes to immigration type issues and for those who are coming and or already here?
Well, first thing, I think it's important, and I think Attorney General Ashcroft even testified at one time and that had that wall been broken down before 9/11, there is reason to believe that the foreign intelligence capability would have identified three or four actors of 9/11 prior to 9/11, and had it been shared with the FBI previous, again, you can't say if it had been shared, the incidents could have been avoided. But there's some reason to believe that that they may have been able to blunt the attacks if that information was shared. That's history. Going forward, I think the lines are really blurred now. I think they're really blurred. I think it's difficult to argue, at least from my experience, to suggest that this whole question of illegal immigration plays into that a broader concern the administration has raised consistently and around a potential terrorist attack. In my experience as Secretary of Homeland Security, while we dealt with immigration with fewer resources and rare was the occasions where we were even an inkling that they were going to use illegal immigrants, the terrorists were going to use illegal immigrants to advance their cause in the United States. That's not to say that they could use the means by which these coyotes and these organizations, these criminal organizations, were channeling illegals and contraband and drugs to the United States. It's not to say that it could not be used to bring in terrorists, but I don't think it's really germane to the debate right now on combating terrorism directly, anyhow.
Right. So in that domestic surveillance, domestic security sphere, the Fourth Amendment applies. There's good. Solid precedence on that. Foreign intelligence, you've got FISA and other regulatory measures. As they blur and we talk about the vertical information sharing issue, how does that impact information going down from the federal government to state and local? Fourth Amendment, we have exclusionary rule and all the criminal rights and processes that attach versus pure intelligence functions that state and local authorities really don't have that expertise in enforcing. What's their role on that end of information if we're dealing with foreign intelligence leading to targeting specific individuals in the U.S.?
Again, I think it's a very appropriate question, and the legitimacy of access, I mean, the constitutionality of the access to whatever information they might, if they even chose to share it locally, and you mentioned previously some within the intelligence community have legitimate concerns about sharing that information with the state and locals, with the fear that the sharing of the information itself might compromise sources and methods. But the constitutional challenge, is frankly, from my perspective, is not one. It's primarily the federal government. It's the agency's responsibilities that it's that the acquisition of that information and the process by which they gained it has to meet constitutional muster. You could see potentially how if it failed to pass constitutional if they acquired it in a way that later on after the fact was proven to be was demonstrated to be unconstitutional, then whatever action they may have taken against the terrorists would be tainted and possibly whatever potential action would be disposed of by a court that said, well, just like anything else, you achieved that information inappropriately, it was unconstitutional, you tainted the prosecution. I still say that the primary responsibility to ensure that the information was achieved within the limits of the Fourth Amendment rests at the federal level, not at the local level, because it could very well taint what they do if, in fact, they are empowered to do something with that information.
Taking
the fruit of the poison tree, absolutely.
Right, yeah. And I suppose that there then are limits on how technologies developed for intelligence gathering purposes might be used in law enforcement missions then.
Well, I think that's interesting. I think Whether you're a federal law enforcement agency or you're a local law enforcement agency, you're still, I mean, the Fourth Amendment still applies. I mean, you and I, I did a little bit of criminal defense and prosecution work way back when. But, you know, if you're trying to get covert access to a computer, maybe not because you think they're a terrorist, you think they're involved in some cyber crime, or if you want to equip equipment interference, or if you wanted to put a listening device, you're still going to have to go through the Fourth Amendment is still going to apply. So I didn't mean but in my response to your previous question to suggest in any way that when local law enforcement acts on its own, absent any connection at all with the federal government, they don't have the same limits on use of existing technology that the federal government would have if it was using similar technology for intelligence gathering purposes. The rules apply at all levels. One of the more interesting notions, I think, and I go back to the federal government, what the local government can't do as well as the federal government can is image development, Cygnet intelligence. And so, again, there are some capabilities that the federal government can have that can be used by local law enforcement. In either case, whenever they're securing, gaining that information, we have to be very, very sure that it's done within the confines and the restrictions and the limits of our Fourth Amendment.
And
I mean, I would tell you candidly, I don't know how folks on the phone feel about it, but I'm not comfortable as a citizen, even as a lawyer, with the federal government having access to metadata. But that's Tom Ridge's opinion.
Looking at the cousin of information sharing, and I suppose that would be capability sharing, which is what we were just talking about, but in a more tangible sense, not just technologies, but military equipment and training. You mentioned earlier, you know, alleged militarization of law enforcement. Is some of that equipment and training useful to law enforcement agencies in their role of assisting in counterterrorism efforts?
Well, I think more often than not, I think the training is very useful. I mean, I personally don't like to see the local law enforcement community show up like a paramilitary force, because they're not. Roaming around in Humvees, it makes me uncomfortable. But I do think there may be some military equipment. I could see giving law enforcement night vision goggles if they've got surveillance responsibilities. I could see them giving some communications equipment that the military has used in order to upgrade their own capabilities locally. But I think the training component, particularly in the area of counterterrorism, would be a critical and a very important contribution in assisting the locals to support the federal government's effort in counterterrorism. Now, there's a lot of useful training that the military can pass on down to the locals, and that's it's a great resource for them.
Well, thank you, Governor. We've covered quite a wide range of topics and info pieces in a very short amount of time. I think it's a good time now to open the floor for questions, and hopefully the audience members can dig in a little bit more to the extent they want to. Dean?
Terrific. Thank you, Adam. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our expert, or I suppose you could ask a question of Adam Perlman as well, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone while we're waiting to see who rings in. Let me make a brief commercial announcement. We'll be doing our next telephone call tomorrow, Friday the 17th at 3 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number. Details are available on our website, but it's an American Bankers Association and Washington Federal lawsuit against the federal government and the Fed in particular. Today, of course, we're talking about local and state and federal partnerships with Governor Tom Ridge. We've got one question pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your phone. Let's take our first call of the day.
Thank you, and good afternoon. I have a question you didn't touch on, but it was an effect that DHS had done was to purchase billions of dollars of ammunition, which seemed to be a kind of a form of gun control and driving up the price of ammunition. And wanted to know if you could comment on that.
It's a fair question. I can't comment on it. The only thing I could say to you is, in my experience as both governor and working with local law enforcement, I never, in all my years in that capacity, never heard a complaint from local law enforcement that they needed more ammunition. It's one of those things that I have. I don't know the nature of the ammunition that was shared with them or whether they were purchased. I do worry a little bit. I don't want to turn local law enforcement, I don't want to turn my state police into a paramilitary organization, but I can't really comment on the ammunition buy. I don't know enough about it to comment.
Our lines are wide open. If you have a question, you need to push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let me ask a follow-up question while we're waiting to see if anybody else rings in. And that's on the militarization of police or the arming of police. One of the arguments I always hear, at least to some degree in favor of that, is that the military ought to be at least as well equipped as, if not the common criminal, then the gangs or the organized criminals. And if they have automatic weapons piercing rounds the police ought to have the same or better. You want to address that a little bit?
Yeah, I think, listen, it's force on force. It's capability against capability. There may be limits, but when it comes to the kind of arms and ammunition you may need, I can make a straight face and a very reasoned argument to support that initiative. I probably draw the line at that point, unless you can convince me otherwise. But if it's force on force, then at least there ought to be selective capability, and not necessarily with everybody in the police force. That makes no sense at all to me. But with your specially trained counterterrorism units, with your SWAT teams, those who specialize in dealing with the gangs, with the drug runners and et cetera. Yeah, I certainly think having that capability matching force on force is appropriate. You know, one thing I did want to say to your audience, if I could, if you didn't mind, Adam, because this is obviously a question about values and Fourth Amendment and freedoms and et cetera. But when we got together to build the Department of Homeland Security, my deputy and I, Deputy former Admiral Jim Loy, Coast Guard, convened a couple of day session without any external help from anybody living in and around the Beltway to write out our vision and our mission statement. And the vision statement, I think, is very important for this group to appreciate. The first thing we said as the vision for Homeland Security was preserving our freedoms, then protecting America, we secure our homeland. And because of the Federalist Society is focused in many ways around that first element, preserving our freedoms, then protecting America, we secure the homeland. And I think we were the first agency that had a congressionally mandated privacy officer. And one of the challenges we have going forward, and you alluded to it a couple of times, Adam, in some of your questions, as the technology continues to improve, at the lines between domestic and foreign collection continue to be blurred. But there's no blurring of the lines as to the Fourth Amendment. There's no blurring of the lines as to how we go about securing information, not only combat terrorism, but to deal with the criminal element as well.
Indeed. Governor, you'd mentioned the anecdote about Commissioner Davis in the wake of the Boston bombings and the scenario of brothers. What is there a principled forgive the use of the word trigger for at what point information is credible enough to be shared? What's the threshold when an individual will be known to the FBI is a pretty broad and vague concept.
Sure. Well, I think there you rely, and again, I don't want the audience to misconstrue my remarks. Somebody, somebody at the federal level, since that's really the epicenter of the intelligence gathering capabilities of the country to combat terrorism, will have to make a decision as to when it is appropriate to share that information, under what circumstances, and with whom. I understand that completely. I use that as a point of reference. Obviously, and I'm not sure what the circumstances were, someone in the FBI or some individuals in the FBI decided there wasn't enough there to share it. I can't tell you what the threshold would be. I have in my own mind what it might be. But I think, more importantly, we still have to overcome an inertia where we don't take advantage, under the right circumstances, with capabilities at the state and local level to enhance our counterterrorism capability in the states. That vertical relationship is critical. It can't be used daily, but there, I'm sure there's very specific times and under certain circumstances where, frankly, I bet it the FBI would feel good about having additional support in a local community or two. They just don't have enough FBI agents to do everything they're called upon to do by the federal government and by the citizens of this country. So take advantage of the 700,000 men and women out there. And that means you may tell a couple of people every once in a while with very specific information. It's not like you're sending out a law enforcement bulletin.
Should that threshold be somewhere below imminence? I don't know.
I think that's a good question. I think it should be. If there I've not had any opportunity to discuss this with some of my friends in the FBI, but I would like them, maybe the answer is this: if we had two more people in XYZ city, then we would put them on this person or persons, because that's how close we are thinking they need the surveillance. It's probably more granular than that. I think the greatest challenge is just almost I said this before when I took over the department, I say it now. We've gone from a Cold War mentality when we said need to know, I think, to a post 9/11 mentality where we need to share. And like I've always felt in terms of emergency preparedness, it's better to be more prepared than less. It's better to err on the side of sharing from time to time information than not sharing. Realize it's more qualitative and subjective than a precise definition, but I do think we've failed over years to take advantage of some real extraordinary talent and mission-oriented patriots at the local level in our law enforcement.
Adam, it's Dean Reuter. We do have another question from our audience. Should we take another call now?
Yeah, please.
Let's do that. If you, again, would like to join the queue for a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Go ahead, caller.
Sure. Thank you. It's David Emerson at the Berkeley chapter of the Federalist Society. A couple of quick questions, if I may. One has to do with this sort of notion of trust and being trustworthy. I guess the revelations regarding the NSA's Delete Data Collection Program and the extent to which the information was used and misused, have those, undermined the ability of organizations to be trusted? And are they acting in a trustworthy manner? So that's one question insofar as Homeland Security goes. The other question has to do with the sanctuary cities and whether or not the sanctuary city policies are hindering cooperation at the Homeland Security level, going far beyond just the immigrant sanctuary issues themselves.
Yeah. Let me try to respond to the question of trust as well. Initially, trust is like it's that intangible that is built upon whether it's a personal relationship or agency to agency. I think it has been generally eroded. not just in the agencies, but I think trust in government writ large over the past several years has been eroded. And in broader context, we thought the regulators would do a better job. They didn't. You have a financial crisis. We thought we were not aware of the data collection program until it was brought to our attention. We never thought the government was going to do that, and they never quite made the case for doing it. So I think the whole question of trust permeates not only information sharing, but the role and relationship government has with every individual citizen. The second question with the sanctuary cities, it is conceivable that in the midst of all those illegal immigrants that are hiding, that you might find in that in those venues, it may be a reasonable hiding place for terrorists to act. But as we've seen before, the terrorist actions that we have unfortunately documented with the death of dozens of people over the past several years since 9/11, those individuals were operating in plain daylight. We just weren't able to detect them. So I think sanctuary cities is a separate issue that has to be dealt with and will be dealt with by this administration. I don't quite see the connection with counterterrorism. Not saying that there couldn't be one. Again, I think it's remote. I think sanctuary cities in and of itself is a problem.
Governor, go ahead.
I was just going to say, Adam, we don't have any questions pending from our audience if you have another question for the governor.
Yeah. Well, I would ask that gentleman if we would follow up on this. It was a good question, particularly on the sanctuary cities. I'd be very interested in his point of view, if you don't mind.
David Emerson, you're still on if you can share your opinion.
I sure am. I mean, the question had to do more with the crossover between the trust between agencies on one level at the for Homeland Security, but an explicit order not to trust and not to share for sanctuary city matters, and whether or not then that's an issue, whether it could be exploited, which is I think what you refer to. But overall, you know, can we dial up or modulate or selectively enforce trust in one policy area and not have it be impact others?
Well, it's a good question. And perhaps my response was far too broad. When it comes to the federal government working with the law enforcement, whether in a community that has been previously designated, self-designated as a sanctuary city, that should in no way, in my judgment, create a firewall between the federal government sharing counterterrorism-related information with the local law enforcement. If that's the point you were driving at, that would be a contrivance. Would not be good public policy, not good counterterrorism policy, period.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. But Adam, the floor is wide open right now if you have another question.
Sure. Somewhat related to that answer, but also rewinding a little bit to the need to share concept that you introduced after 9/11. You know, the sharing preference that you spearheaded, I think, there were a lot of hurdles to it, but a lot of progress was made for about a decade before Manning and then Snowden.
Yep.
And does that suggest that we are as much in the information realm as with, I guess, the Homeland Security enterprise generally? Are we supposed to think of this as a risk management model? Is that an appropriate way of looking at both the amount that we share as well as how to handle potential threats?
The question that you raise and the manner in which you raise it, I think, talks to, I think, in the 21st century and in what I call the whole area of the digital forevermore, the ability to access information through electronic means and the impact, whether it's a law enforcement criminal matter, whether it's a counterterrorism matter, it's a whole question of privacy. And at what point in our effort to be safer and more secure, do we, and I hope the answer is we accept the notion that because we are generating more information and because we are necessarily generating more data, that law enforcement writ large can have access to it without going and without going outside the lines of the Constitution. I mean, I know even at the local level, there are technology vendors and there's capabilities out there that help local law enforcement access social media platforms. And with these sophisticated algorithms that people use these days, while you can use it, legitimate concerns, there may be through that social media, you may find evidence of a crime, you may actually find confessions relating to incidents or many things you could do. But again, there's other improper uses of that information in the wrong hands, or maybe in the right hands, but for the wrong purposes. So I think as we get into, as more and more data is generated in the digital forevermore, the broader question is not just in the area of combating crime and law enforcement, because we're never going to put the data genie back in the bottle, but who has access to the data, for what purpose can they use the data, how long can they have the data, and we as a country, and I think the legal profession needs to be very involved in this, we have to circumscribe who, what, when, where, and why, and we're just beginning to have those conversations, and I think it's critically important. I think that's where the legal profession must make a significant contribution to the managing the risk and the risk that I want to manage. I don't want to surrender my privacy in order to feel slightly safer or more secure. And I think that's something that this country is going to have to grapple with in the long term. I know during the first couple of years of Homeland Security, people would say to me, "Oh, I don't care if the FBI is listening to my conversation. I haven't done anything wrong. I don't care if it makes me safe. It's okay with me." And you know, you'd have to remind in a very polite and respectful way, "Oh, no, no. If they want information about you, there's a way they do it. It's called the Fourth Amendment. They need to do that under any set of circumstances." And frankly, once you give away, once you start surrendering those freedoms, you begin undermining the very system of government democracy that's giving you the opportunity to enjoy life in this country.
I think as we get close to the top of the hour here, excellent points, and I think may segue well into perhaps another program in the future where we can get into how encryption debates factor into all of this. But I think if there are no more questions from the floor, thank you, Governor, very, very much for your time and your candor. I'll remind callers that the next call in this series, the second call, will be Monday, February 27th, on public-private partnerships and cybersecurity applications. And with that, Dean, closing ceremonies, or if anybody else has any last-minute questions, we're happy to take them.
I think we've had our final question, Adam. Thank you. Let me join in thanking you and thanking Governor Ridge for joining us. You've mentioned the next call in this series, the next Teleforum call altogether, is scheduled for tomorrow at 3 p.m. Do check the website and check your emails for further details on that. But until the next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.